I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
On today's show, Francesca de Torres on her latest novel, Salt Blood.
Francesca de Torres is a novelist, poet, and academic. She is the author of four previous novels, published in more than 20 languages. In addition to a collection of poems, her poetry is widely published in journals and anthologies. Today we're going to be talking about her first historical novel, which is Salt Blood. Francesca, welcome to Little Atoms.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, then, would you tell us how you would describe this novel?
I would describe Salt Blood as a story of the sea above all and about two remarkable female pirates who adventured upon it. It's historical fiction. It's based upon the only two documented real-life female pirates of what's known as the Golden Age of Piracy. And in particular, it's about Mary Read, who led a life that is so extraordinary that it's difficult to persuade people who haven't encountered her story before that she was a real historical figure. I don't want to spoil Salt Blood too much, but without spoiling the book, I can say that Mary was raised as a boy, served in the Navy and the Army before ultimately becoming a pirate, and her story doesn't get any less remarkable from that point.
So tell us when you first discovered Mary and thought this would be a good story to tell.
Oh, this is a frustrating one for me because as a former academic, I would really love it if I had some sort of academically credible story that I was in a library leafing through a dusty tome. But the depressing truth is that I was sitting on the floor with my young son doing a horrible history's jigsaw puzzle, and it made passing reference to two female pirates. And it was just enough to sort of prompt me to go and Google these women, Anne Bonny and Mary Read. And it was one of those cases of sort of love at first sight. You know, I was halfway through the Wikipedia entry and I was completely done for. I knew with sort of certainty that is fairly rare as a writer that this was it. This was the next novel that I had to write. I, of course, went far beyond the Wikipedia article. My father's a historian and he would be horrified if he thought that was where it began, let alone where it ended. But over the next few years, I researched Mary Read in particular and just became fixated on the story of her life.
Well, after I'd finished the novel, I did go and read the Wikipedia page on Mary myself, because I was sort of expecting that we would maybe talk about the historical Mary as opposed to your fictionalized Mary. But I mean, her life story, her real life story is told in the book very accurately. I mean, it's, you know, it's some of the details on the Wikipedia page I was sure were fictional things that you would come up with. So I guess let's talk about then something about who your Mary is as opposed to the historical one, in terms of like what you wanted to do with the character, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, because in fact, we can talk more about the historical sources, because what's interesting is that although her story is really remarkable, we don't have a lot of facts. We have only a few documents and some broad brushstrokes. So there was quite a lot of room for speculation and imagination. I definitely write about things that can't possibly be verified, but I set myself a challenge of trying to not put anything in the book that, you know, definitely couldn't have happened, that was definitely at odds with the historical record, scant though it is. But Mary, I was at pains to try to make her a person who was more than her remarkable life story. Otherwise, she's just She's just the events that happened to her, and that's quite reactive. And I was always in search of the woman beyond those events. And I think where I landed with her, or where she started to emerge very strongly, was as someone of just enormous resourcefulness, because she's raised as a boy. For complicated financial reasons, her mother passes her off as her recently dead young half-brother so that her mother can continue claiming his allowance. And so she's raised with this is done to her, it's imposed on her. But rather than being a sort of passive figure in all this, she discovers a tremendous creativity and playfulness in this fluidity. So instead of suffering from her mother's imposition of another gender, she says at one point something along the lines of, I'm paraphrasing here, you know, my greatest secret isn't that I'm not a boy. My greatest secret is that I like it. So she learns this lesson from her hideous mother, and her mother's a real nightmarish figure. And that is speculation on my part. I had great fun creating a hellish mum. But what she gets from her mum is this almost miraculous sense that you can invent your identity, that you can choose on any given day who you might be, not just in terms of gender, but in terms of everything else. And so she says at various points, you know, who I am to be next, I am not yet sure. And she makes herself, which is such a courageous thing for a woman in the early 1700s, which is where most of this novel takes place, to forge her own identity. It's such a leap of imagination and courage. And I think that's what defines Mary Read, at least the version of her that jumped out as I was writing Salt Blood.
And so spending all this time acting as a boy, as a brother, as a dead brother, enables her eventually to escape the situation and go and join the Navy. So let's talk about what the political situation was at the time. Why is she joining the Navy? What is the Navy involved in then?
The sources are so vague that it's not even crystal clear exactly which war she was said to have served in. But by my best reckoning, it must have been the War of the Spanish Succession, which meant that, I mean, England was pretty much in a state of perpetual war with its European neighbours at that point. But in particular, the Spanish King Charles had died in 1700, and he'd left Europe battling over control of the Spanish Empire. There were the Bourbons who wanted to see Philip of Anjou on the Spanish throne. But Great Britain and what became known as the Grand Alliance feared that that would then combine France and Spain and throw off the balance of power of all Europe. So there was a nasty and protracted war. But Mary, I think, in the novel is less interested in the big picture of war. You know, her immediate experience is so far removed from that of kings and queens and empires. For her, it's just a way of getting away from a life. She's at this point in service in a rich widow's house. And for her, it's a way of finding a life that is bigger than the confines of this very narrow, restrictive existence. So she joins the Navy in disguise as a man or a boy at that point. And she ends up even moving beyond that eventually and joining the army as well, continuing in the same war.
What would life aboard a boat? She joins a ship called the Resolve as a powder boy.
I was amazed at the things I learned about the Royal Navy. I spent years doing nothing but research about this. And even when I wasn't sort of working, I was reading, you know, Hornblower and Master and Commander, which are obviously Napoleonic wars, but still for sort of nautical colour, I was so fully immersed in this world. So life on the Royal Navy was incredibly dangerous, incredibly uncomfortable, and almost complete lack of comfort of any kind, of privacy. Disease was far more dangerous than the enemy, and they hadn't yet solved the mystery of scurvy. So long voyages were plagued by scurvy, and contagious outbreaks of things like dysentery just ripped through the Navy. Conditions were so bad that generally until a ship's commission, you know, the particular mission for which that crew had been hired, until that commission was completed, they were almost always refused shore leave when they docked somewhere, because it was assumed that so many of them would desert. That's what the conditions were like. You often weren't paid. If you were paid at all, it wasn't until the conclusion of the ship's commission. So you would be existing in incredibly harsh conditions, in close confinement. The shifts were 4 hours on, 4 hours off. So it's really not comparable to any sort of life elsewhere. You enter a whole different world. And that's before you even get to the facts of battle and war and imprisonment and potential, you know, violent death, which was no small part of it. So The conditions were unbelievably difficult. At the same time, there was, I think, a great sense of camaraderie and fellowship amongst the sailors aboard. And certainly for Mary in Saltblood, that's where she starts to experience something beyond the restrictive world of her mother and the big house where she worked, and starts to forge true friendships and a greater sense of herself. And although it's very difficult to romanticise life in the Royal Navy, she does fall for the sea, and her passion for the sea features of the rest of her life.
Yeah, as you mentioned, she forms a very touching friendship with another sailor called Marston, who she eventually leaves the Navy and goes off and joins the Army with. But I want to talk about a different sailor who we meet at this point, who is Belling, who basically becomes Mary's antagonist throughout the book. Tell us something about where he came from.
Well, Belling is almost a parallel figure to Mary, in that, like Mary, and Belling is not a figure from the historical record, although he plays the role late in the story where he does take on a role that is part of the factual record. He's essentially a sort of bizarro Mary, in that, like Mary, he's born into poverty and is just trying to forge a way for himself. But he's a real malicious, misogynistic piece of work. And that means that he sets himself against Mary, not that he necessarily recognises her for what she is, but that he takes a disliking to her. But what's interesting about those two is that they are kind of twinned. Even while she hates Belling and his vicious, conniving ways and his attempts to do real harm to her, she recognises in his sort of striving desperation something of herself and maybe of what her life could have been. So when he reappears later in her life, she acknowledges, even though she hates him and he's such a despicable little rat of a man, but she does acknowledge that he probably knows her better than anyone else at that stage in her life, and his life has been closer to hers than she would maybe like to admit.
And once Mary's left the Navy and joined the Army, eventually she meets another sailor, Dan Janssens, who, through various contrivances, which we won't talk about here, ends up becoming her husband, and she spends a short period of time out of the Army as an innkeeper in what would become the Netherlands. Yeah, tell us something about this marriage, because this is something that, you know, the Wikipedia tells me is true, right down to the name of the inn that they owned.
That's right, the Three Horseshoes, which, as she says, you know, Dan says it's meant to be good luck, and she thinks, well, Three Horseshoes isn't good luck unless you've got a three-legged horse. Look, Dan Janssens, the name is fictional, but it is recorded that she married a Flemish soldier and left the Army to be with him. What's interesting about that is that it renders her story quite a palatable one to the other men and even the officers in the Army. By all accounts, this was greeted really positively as kind of a heartwarming, thrilling story. Her troop got together and gave them money for their wedding gift. So this rebellious sort of subversive thing that she's done by passing as a man for all this time is kind of rendered palatable and safe by its conversion into a heterosexual love story. The sort of potential queerness of she and Dan falling for each other while she's ostensibly a man is detoothed safely, and everyone can pat them on the back and say, well done you, good trick, now go away and be safely heterosexual. So she does marry him and they do love each other and he's a good man, but I think she finds at that point that her life is once again rendered small. And Mary's not built for a small life. So despite the consolations of marriage to a kind man and much greater comfort than she ever experienced in either the Navy or the Army, she also finds herself restless. And there's a real contrast, I think, between the great expansive openness of the ocean that she's fallen in love with and the sort of damp, enclosed, water level existence that she encounters in the Netherlands. I have to say, I'd apologise to any Dutch people who read this book. I really love the Netherlands, but Mary's view of the place is quite uncharitable. She feels it's a very stagnant place that's slowly sinking. And during her marriage, although she loves Dan, she's sort of waiting for the sea to come and claim her, which it ultimately does after he dies.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Francesca de Torres, and we're talking about her new novel, Salt Blood. And Francesca, you've just mentioned that the sea eventually reclaims Mary. She joins a crew of a cargo ship and spends some time on that. There's a long section of the book which details the travails she has with the various crew members of that ship. And this eventually leads her to Nassau in the Bahamas, and what was then the sort of fledgling Pirates Republic of what you mentioned earlier, the golden age of piracy. So let's spend the second half of the book talking about pirates. What was going on in Nassau then? Tell us how they'd sort of set up the place and what the idea behind this Pirates Republic was.
Well, Nassau was a very paradoxical place because on the one hand, you know, it was the nest of pirates, as it was known, or the centre of what was rather grandiosely known as the Republic of Pirates. It was a cluster of pirates, and piracy was a real thorn in the side of nations and traders and settlers in that period. But while on the one hand it was this quite grand mission, on the other hand it was also a shithole. It was small, had open sewers, was a collection of sort of shanty-style ale tents and shacks thrown together. So it was a place with grand notions that were never really fully realised, because the Pirate Republic, although it sometimes talked the talk, was very rarely able to walk the walk. It was a place of internecine squabbles between crews and backstabbing and violence and small-scale crime. So Nassau was never a grand pirate base. It was more like a grubby little nest where they sort of grubbed along together. But piracy was booming at that point because the war had finished and the Royal Navy had been more or less bankrupted during the War of Spanish Succession. And so you suddenly find thousands upon thousands of sailors who are unemployed and have no skills other than hunting enemy ships and raiding them. So you can see why so many people turned to piracy. And the other reason, of course, is that there's always been a slippery slope between privateering and piracy. So during a war, privateering was a common and respectable way for sailors to make their living. It was essentially being a pirate with a letter of marque, an official document from the monarch that gave you permission to raid enemy ships during a time of war. That's all well and good while there's a war on, but as soon as that's over, you've got a whole lot again of skilled, violent sailors who are out of a job. And a lot of those people found themselves willingly or otherwise turning to piracy.
And why there? So obviously, I mean, it's the Caribbean, even though NASA's not as nice as it is now. I'm sure it's a lot nicer than a lot of other places in the world. But what's the sort of context as to why piracy is so thriving in this particular area? Obviously, you've mentioned that the War of the Spanish Succession has finished, but like obviously the Spaniards and like Spanish ships were like the targets of those privateers before. So why the Caribbean?
Pirates go where the prizes are, and they would be seasonal. They would often head further north up the east coast of America when the summer was good, and further south as it started to freeze. Essentially, they were targeting the big, valuable cargoes. And at this time, you're talking about empires making a fortune largely on the labor of enslaved people in tobacco and also gold from the New World and the Spanish Empire. So you've got tobacco money and tobacco, sugar money and sugar, and Spanish gold still coming out of the New World. And all of these cargoes are making their way back, essentially, from the Americas, often through the Bahamas and back towards England, and to the rest of Europe. So it's where empire is enriching itself, and it's where pirates are able to strike them. And I'm sure that that's why there was eventually such a brutal crackdown upon piracy. It wasn't just that they were criminals. They were criminals that were threatening the wealth of empires ultimately, and also dissuading settlers to settle in the colonies, which was a real problem for English and Spanish colonizers. So there were lots of reasons why they were a real thorn in the side of empire, but they went where the money was and they were very good at it. But it's important to remember that a lot of the piracy that happened in real life was not these sort of sexy, glamorous Spanish galleons laden with gold. A lot of the time you're talking about smaller ships and really unglamorous cargoes that they would steal, sometimes as unsexy as, you know, shipping tackle and their catch. So it was very rare for these really lucrative, massive catches. It was more often a sort of hodgepodge of what they could get. And pirates were rarely operating in big boats, partly because the Bahamas are notoriously full of really shallow water. So they were using small ships very often, sort of sloops and so on, which were harder to catch by the big Navy boats were sort of at a loss amongst the shallow shoals of the Bahamas.
And you talk in the book about there are characters that are real life pirates, like Blackbeard being probably the most famous one. But another real life pirate, Calico Jack, is a major character in the novel. Tell me something about who he was.
We don't know a huge amount about Jack Rackham, or Calico Jack as he was known. I really became very fond of Jack. He's essentially a showman. You know, his nickname, Calico Jack, is the result of these flashy Indian calico clothes that he would wear with really elaborate prints on them. So he was very distinctive. And so I had this sense of him as a man who was very consciously fashioning his identity and his own narrative. He understands the power of storytelling. And so he is not terribly concerned with the truth. He's concerned with which story will be effective in any given situation. He's a very charismatic leader, and he was known to have been Anne Bonny's lover. And they got married, though. I don't know that it's a marriage that would be recognized by any law or religion officially. But Mary too falls for Calico Jack, not in the sexual sense, but in the sense that she recognizes that his incredible charisma and above all storytelling ability allows him to draw people into his orbit. And so he runs a very tight crew, not a massive crew and not a crew that was successful for a long time. You know, Calico Jack has a kind of outsized fame given how relatively small and short-lived his pirating career was. But there's something about this flashy, outrageous figure that I think keeps drawing us back to his story.
I haven't actually looked this up, but it struck me that Calico Jack is presumably who Captain Jack Sparrow is based on.
I think that that's likely. And I also think, you know, my son is loves the Tintin stories, though we have a lot of discussions about casual racism in those books. And I also think that Rackham, Red Rackham, in those books is probably also drawn from him. So again, he has this sort of disproportionate impact on the popular consciousness even today for someone who was really basically a small-time criminal. He wasn't a character who was involved in pirating on a grand scale. But there was something about this charismatic figure that allows us still to, you know, the name Rackham is still in the popular consciousness all this time later.
There's another real historical character in the novel, Woods Rogers, who becomes the new governor of Nassau and is sort of central to the attempt to clean it up and to tackle piracy. And he has like a really interesting wider life to that as well. Tell us something about who he was.
Woods Rogers is a fascinating figure, and I have actually become so fixated on Woods Rogers that I'm fairly certain that my next novel is going to deal more with him. So Woods Rogers made his name long time before he became governor of Nassau by undertaking this famous circumnavigation of the earth. And that was, you know, fairly remarkable at the time. And he published an account of it, which you can still read today. He had this idea about piracy that I don't think was really as much ideological as it was financial. He set up a private corporation that was going to profit from repressing piracy. And he was a very canny player. He went out there with this idea that he would do this favor for empire and be richly rewarded. It didn't quite work out like that. He did succeed in many ways because he was part of this big push from England in particular to crush piracy once and for all. But he was then sort of hung out to dry by his former supporters in England and left really undermanned and undersupported in this mutinous island full of pirates. So he's a villain to the pirates, but to me, he wasn't an entirely unsympathetic figure. And Mary actually gets hold of this book that he had published about his earlier journey and reads it and has this experience of sort of getting to know him through his words rather than just through seeing him on the island. So they have a not entirely straightforward relationship, and he's a fascinating figure. I think he's not as well known as he could be.
And just one more character then, who you've mentioned but we've not talked about, another marvellous, huge, larger-than-life character in this novel, Anne Bonny. Tell us who she was.
Well, Anne Bonny was the other documented female pirate of this golden age of piracy. And the similarities between her and Mary's story are just uncanny. You know, in separate countries, at separate times, for different reasons, they were both raised as boys. So she was an illegitimate child whose father passed her off as a visiting male relative rather than admitting that she was his illegitimate child that he'd had with a servant. She then became a rich planter's daughter when her father fled Ireland and the scandal associated with her birth, and ultimately marries a small-time pirate, James Bonny, and ends up in Nassau, which is where she encounters Jack Rackham and Mary Read. The relationship between them isn't documented, but in Salt Blood, I imagine that she and Mary become lovers because the bonds between them and the uncanny similarities between their lives are so fascinating. But Mary is the antithesis of Anne. Anne is a sort of marvelous monster. She, in the version that I imagine, is almost pure id. She will go for what she wants without scruple and entirely without shame. She's a creature of enormous appetites, both sexual and in almost every other way. She's passionate. She is, and this is from the historical record, she was known as the Great Whore of New Providence, the island on which Nassau was found. And one of my favourite lines from the historical record is this line from Charles Johnson, Captain Charles Johnson, a pseudonym for the man who wrote this book called The General History of the Pirates, which is the most detailed account that we have of Anne and Mary. And he describes in this glorious line, describes Anne as being not altogether so reserved in point of chastity, which is an understatement, but she's a sort of wonderful figure and such a stark contrast to Mary, who's, in order to survive, has had to live a more contained and careful life. And then Anne just explodes into her life and breaks everything apart. Anne exists almost entirely in the present. Mary struggles to let go of things in the past, and she learns from Anne how to simply cut the rope of what ties you. You know, when Anne marries her no good first husband, it says something along the lines of James Bonny was a door and she walked straight through him. She just used him to get away from her father and the situation that she didn't like. And she continues throughout her life to just cut those ties. So Mary sees her for what she is, but loves her perhaps not in spite of that, but because of it. Anne was a tremendously entertaining character to write.
To finish it off then, can I get you to read us a bit?
Sure. So this is an extract from slightly compiled extract from when Mary has embarked upon her life of piracy and is in a relationship with Anne. who at the same time is in a relationship with Jack Rackham. I feel no guilt about this taking that we do. I give no quarter, for I have been given none. Nobody ever gave me anything, not even a name. I had to live in my brother's name just like I lived in his leftover clothes. For years, I felt myself a stowaway in my own life, but the sea has taught me this. Such days as I have been granted, they are mine. These long salt days at sail are something different, something newer and more strange than anything history shall record of Nassau and its Republic of Pirates. This is our own republic, the Republic of Salt. Salt on the wind and on my cutlass blade, the white tide mark of salt on Jack's bright clothes when they've dried in the sun, the white crust of salt on Anne's eyelashes after we swim. Sea salt, salt meat, the salt on Anne's flesh when I take her in my mouth. Salt blood. It is the sixth year of the reign of King George. These are the first days of the First Republic of Salt. We are away.
So I've been talking to Francesca de Torres. We've been talking about her new novel, Salt Blood, which is out now in the UK from Bloomsbury. Francesca, thank you so much for taking the time to share it with me.
A pleasure to talk with you, Neil.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented, and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at Ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.